Hello, my name is Andreina.
And my name is Gabriela, and this is Wicks and Candles,
a podcast about two sisters and their obsession with period film.
Join us on a trip through palaces and manors, balls and tea parties, and a lot of dresses, carriages, and of course, wicks and candles.
In this episode, Barry Lyndon. Gabby, today's movie is monumental in a way. Not only among period film, but film history in general.
Yes, Nene. It's definitely a little bit intimidating. And this is why I'm very happy that we have some support today to discuss this movie. We have a special guest to join us.
Exactly. We have a very special guest. And actually, he's one of the people who suggested Barry Lyndon when we did a questionnaire last season to us for suggestions. This is an incredible moment personally for me, because this is a friend from Venezuela whom I met when we were both enrolled in university in Maracaibo to study journalism. His name is Julio Urdaneta. And Julio is based in the United States in the DC area, and he works in corporate communication, so he's still a journalist. Julio is also an avid music and movies fan. He's a frequent concertgoer, a self-proclaimed foodie. In short, he's a man who nurtures his passions. Welcome, Julio.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. It's a sort of homecoming today to be with you and Gabby again. And thank you so much for this warm welcome. It's good to be back with you guys. Home.
You're back home.
Yes.
So nice. Welcome to the podcast, Julio. We are really, truly honored that you are here today.
Thank you. Thank you. Likewise.
We really are. And it's extremely exciting for us. Thank you for those beautiful words. Yeah, it's a homecoming for Gabby and I as well. It's been over 25 years since we last spoke. So this is truly an amazing moment. But let's get to business. And as always, Gabby, before we start, can you please give us some facts about the movie?
Sure, Nene, with pleasure. This is, as you mentioned in our intro, a monumental film. So I hope I can give you a very short summary of the facts, because it's a very lengthy production. The film Barry Lyndon was written, directed, and produced by Stanley Kubrick. It was released in 1975, and it's the 10th feature film out of his filmography, which is only 13 films long. It is based on the 1844 novel, The Luck of Barry Lyndon, written by William Makepeace Thackeray, who is also known for his novel Vanity Fair. Kubrick did make a whole lot of major changes on the plot of the story for the screenplay adaptation. And maybe one of the most important ones is the perspective of the narration. In the book, the story is told in first person. And for the film, Kubrick changed it to be told from a neutral perspective. The narrator in the film is Michael Horton. The movie stars Ryan O'Neill in the main role of Barry Lyndon, Maria Berenson as Her Ladyship Lyndon. We have a small cameo of Leonard Rossiter as Captain Quinn, one of my favorite characters in the film, I have to add, and Patrick McGee as Chevalier de Balibari, just to mention a few of the main characters. Now to the accolades. This is 1975, so the categories are not exactly the same as they are today, but we can say that it received, in total, 7 nominations for the Academy Awards for the Oscars, and it won 4 of them, including Best Costume Design and Cinematography. And for the directing work, Stanley Kubrick received the BAFTA for this film. Maybe also interesting to note, by the time of its release, the film was criticized by the slow pace and the restrained emotion how that story is told. But by now, I could say the film has reached a certain cult status. I found something interesting also in my research, and I'm going to quote this, in the 2022 Sight and Sound Greatest Films of All Time poll, Barry Lyndon placed 12th in the director's poll and 45th place in the critics' poll, which kind of confirms that, okay, was not that appreciated when it came back, but by now it is considered a masterpiece. So yeah, that's all from my side, Nene. Can you guide us quickly through the plot?
Sure, Gabby, thank you for those facts. As always, already starting to give us lots to think about. Yeah, I'm going to give a brief summary of the plot, as I always try to do. So here it goes. Barry Lyndon tells the story of Redmond Barry, the sole son of his gentleman father, who dies while Redmond is still young. Redmond falls in love with his cousin Nora, and when she decides to marry an English general, Redmond challenges his rival to a duel, an event that will mark the beginning of his adventures beyond Ireland into England and Europe. Through good and bad turns, Redmond will end up serving in the military, traveling across Europe, and later making his way up British aristocracy to become Barry Lyndon. Yeah, so that's a brief summary of the plot of the movie. And I'm not sure how closely it follows the plot of the book, but essentially, this is very high level. And now to a very brief historical context, which we have been doing since season 4 started, and I don't have a whole lot to say here. This book was written in 1844, but the story takes place in the 18th century, specifically in the context and the aftermath of the Seven Years' War, which, according to Wikipedia, happened between 1756 and 1763, and it was a global conflict that involved most of Europe. And it was fought primarily in Europe, but also the Americas and the Asia Pacific. So in England, where the movie mainly takes place, it was King George III who was in the throne at the time. In fact, he reigned from 1760 all the way to 1820. So this is the historical context where the story takes place. All right.
Red, I guess now we're all set up.
Are we ready? Yeah. Are we now ready after all of this? Are we ready to talk about this movie?
I think we are.
I hope so. So, Gabby, do you want to introduce the questions or the topics that we're going to talk about today?
Should I? Yeah. Sure, Nene. Our first question is addressed to our special guest. And it has a little bit to do with a questionnaire we did in our Instagram account, where we asked to our followers which films they would like us to discuss in our podcast. And Julio, who is a very loyal follower of our project, suggested Barry Lyndon. So Julio, you recommended this film to us. Would you like to tell us, what is it about this movie that captures your imagination? And what was your motivation to suggest it for our podcast?
Well, the motivation to suggest it was the fact that even though this movie was released 48 years ago, we still see its influence in movies today. You can see in movies like 1917, like The Libertine, movies, even non-Wicks and Candles movies like Saltburn, you can see that the the mise-en-scène, it's inspired by the work Kubrick did in this movie. And it is indeed a monumental film, because for a movie that was done, like I said, 48 years ago, and still is seen today as technically flawless as it is, and not only with the cinematography, which is absolutely superb, but the attention to detail, to the costumes, to the set designs, the entire technical aspect of the movie is flawless. Yet, what fascinates me about the movie is it's precisely its detachment. It's a cold, calculated, very masculine movie that tells us the story of a very misogynistic and selfish man, a man who doesn't smile, a man who kills with nonchalance, and a man who even we see clear, very, I mean, perhaps not intended at the moment that this movie was released. Perhaps, I mean, Kubrick was a genius, perhaps he did, but with a lot of queer undertones to him, to his character, a lot of queer coding in his in his demeanor and in his relationships, and he uses that as I think he uses that to punish himself and to punish the others around him. It's a movie about, I think it's certainly a movie about toxic masculinity, but it's also a movie about how far can a person go to soothe or to drown demons inside, and how detached you have to be from your own humanity to kill those demons. You know, and it's such a powerful allegory that you can see throughout Kubrick's filmography. How do you have to suppress yourself in order to find redemption? And that really drew me about this movie. That was my main. My main reading of the movie back when I first saw it, and it still stands today.
This is amazing. Thank you so much already for this insight. And there's so much in what you said that I think we would like to decipher and like a surgeon to take on for our conversation. Nene, would you like to add something or comment something? Yes, go ahead.
Yes. You mentioned so many things already, Julio. Why you suggested the movie? I mean, I want to ask you before we go on, how many times have you seen the movie?
Three times.
Three times, okay.
Three times, yes. I just saw it recently, actually, to prepare for this.
Good.
I saw it, I think, yesterday again.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, because it is my first time. So my first time, because for some reason or another, it just fell through the cracks. This was a movie that I've known about the entire of my adult life because it's such a well-known film, and I study film, and it's a movie that is like a must, like in your education. But for some reason or another, I never made my way to it. And you know, it's been actually on our radar for a long time, right? Since we started doing this podcast, we made a huge list of movies, and it's always been there, but somehow we were kind of maybe afraid of it a little bit. Because it's, for me, is much more than a period film. Like it goes beyond the genre. In fact, maybe it predates the genre in a way. if we want to define
yeah
a genre. Well, yeah,
absolutely. And I mean,
yeah, but
what, you know what,
yeah, go ahead.
You know what, it's funny because I thought you had named the podcast because of the movie, because one thing that certainly defines this movie is that it has a lot of wigs and a lot of candles. And the candles actually are pretty important because part of the genius of this movie is that some scenes are shot entirely with candlelight. Yeah. A feat that in 1973 was unheard of, was impossible, you know, and special lenses were actually created and special mechanical tricks have to be done in the cameras to shoot these scenes. And, and even though they were technically complicated to shot, you can still see the quality of the performances. You can see the hand of the director moving the actors in a certain way, the eyes, the sweat coming down, the foreheads, the details in the stitches of the costume. So it's such an incredible feat of, I would say, in filmmaking engineering that is, wow, it's monumental. But then again, it also talks about, you know, how elaborate and how perfect evil can be. How you know, how pristine and flawless the lowest forms of our humanity can be.
Yeah.
And I think the whole film is an allegory of that, you know, of, you know, that how can we be technically perfect and yet still have no soul? Because that's the core of this movie, that this man, he has no soul. And I think he knows it.
Which is funny because one of the notes that I made, during the first part of the film, there is an intermission in the entire film. In the first part, the first act, he cries twice, I guess, if I'm not mistaken. And I wrote down, wow, Barry Lyndon was really emotional. Because this was unusual. And you mentioned it, Julio, this is a very masculine film, full of testosterone. And yet I was impressed to see him crying over the death of the General Krogan. He wept like a baby. And there was another moment where he also cried and was like, wow, this is a nice contrast to this.
When he cries
to the character, yeah.
And see, that's because that's where you encounter the queer undertones of the movie. He cries for two men.
Yeah.
For the general and for the Chevalier de Balivari. And actually in that scene when he cries for the general asks him to kiss him and they kissed in the mouth.
Yeah.
He didn't hesitate one moment.
Words, kiss me, my boy, because it's...
Yeah.
No. And it leads you to believe that they had a relationship before. See, and then when he meets the Chevalier de Balivari, the narrator says that he sees something that disarms him, identifies. He realizes that the Chevalier can be also gay. So that's what, and he's, you know, unable to betray somebody like him. That's why he breaks down. Because he knows, just by seeing this man, that he is in his same closeted situation. I don't think he's gay. I think he's bisexual, but he doesn't know it. And that's how, that's why he cries. He doesn't cry. He doesn't cry when he finds out that Nora married Major Quinn, or when he's robbed, or anything. He just cries when he's encountered with the loss, or when he won with the loss of a man he clearly loved and kissed in the mouth before passing. And when he meets a man that it's clearly coded as gay, and is, but then it, the narrator hides it as, oh, he could see something like him in this man. And I don't think it was the fact that they were both Irish.
No, because he hasn't said one word.
Exactly. He hasn't used his, he hasn't spoken in Irish yet.
I want to say
that that is absolutely a fascinating read of the film. And that's why I asked you how many times you've seen it, because obviously, you know, you can have first impressions, but then after you see it a few times, you start to see other readings clearly. So my reading was different from that. My reading, and I'm going to look at the notes, but it's actually similar in a way that I was, you know, when you're talking about how, you know, that kind of detachment is hiding evil underneath. But my notes were the veneer of respectability, the fragility of civility. And I was talking to Gabby before, we always have like a pre-recording discussion. I was saying, you know, this movie just shows, and I was just talking in general about a critique of the aristocracy, you know, which we see in the movie. And it's just like this veneer of civility and this veneer of elegance and this veneer of, you know, things being good is so thin. It's just, you only need to scratch a tiny little bit and you're going to find all kinds of uncivilized things underneath. That was my take. But, you know, to add to the queer reading of the movie, Barry Lyndon is a very typical character. He's an opportunist. He's a kind of character that just goes through. It's a picaresque. It's based on a picaresque novel, and the style is like this character is kind of like going about in a journey, and things happen to him in a way. So this is kind of the style. And after he gets recruited in the army, he decides to desert the army, and of course, this is illegal. This is a crime. And he one day he has to go. Deliver something, or I don't know, he has to go get water, and he comes upon these two horses,
a gay couple, exactly,
and there's this gay couple talking and it was so beautiful, and they're just, you know, they're being super proper chaps, you know, in their English, right? It's like, it's so funny, but they're being so loving and holding their hands in the water, and he's not in any way, I was like, oh, he's going to use this information for something. And that's what I thought. He's going to use this information of what he's seeing to manipulate the situation for his benefit. But this is the furthest from what he does. It's completely unexpected. He actually says, oh, I'm just going to take the papers of one of these majors or generals, and I'm going to, you know, take their identity and escape. But it's just so casual.
Yeah, he took it like the most normal thing ever. Yeah.
He understands exactly, because he understands that. He understands what he's seeing. And it might be something that he yearns. And he knows also that couple, they're not in a position to say anything or harm him, because if they come clean, they will be punished for being gay. So is the perfect opportunity for him to leave. And it's also, you know, it's just like you were saying, that adds to the narrative that, you know, it's all a facade. Behind this beautiful world of uniforms and civility and war, you know, there's a sequence where the English army just soldiers on, and they're being shot point blank by the French, and they just soldier on because that's what civilized men do.
You know, honorable.
And honorable men do, and they just soldier on without fighting a single shot, and they're being shot at. And but it's all for naught because nobody, I mean, they're all like dead, and they just continue for the sake of keeping up appearances. And
yeah.
And that's exactly what this movie is about. And you mentioned that this movie is a journey. It is, but that is, I think, more to, I mean, I think about the classics, know that you know, the journey, how the journey would change the protagonist. And that was a theme throughout, you know, all the classics of literature. But in this is a breakthrough movie because the protagonist doesn't change at all. From the beginning of the movie, where he's referred to as a boy several times by the narrator, to the last, even though he doesn't have a leg, he lost a leg, and all these terrible things happens to him, he's the same con man from the beginning, a man who never laughs, a man who cries for the other man, a man who. That caught my attention, that it was rare to see him even a smirk, you know.
Emote
anything. So yeah, it's deep, you know. It certainly makes you think about what it is. Just one of those things that makes you think of what it is, what it means to be throughout history, what it means to be a honorable man, what it means to be a man. And I think this movie is
about
that.
This is the fragility that you were mentioning, Nene, that it's so, that this is really a very thin layer, what we as a society would consider civilized or honorable, and that it is, that it takes so little to break that thin layer and bring out the darkest side of a human being. I guess, Nene, you are you're thinking about the same scene that maybe I am thinking. And this is, I guess, also one main topic of the entire film, how the entire tone of the story, of the screenplay, was made to, I would use the word ridicule, to ridicule certain things of humans. In the first part, it was mainly about the war and how the narrator makes, what the narrator says in the storytelling. It is pretty condemning the war and why we make war as humans, why they were in war at all, that it was such a senseless waste of youth and time. And it is all said in a very serious voice, but the undertone is ridiculing what we are seeing. And then in the second part, it does the same with aristocracy. All these aristocrats wearing their sumptuous cost wardrobes and jewels and wigs and makeup, it is all overdone to make it look like this is a ridicule. They make it look like they're a better kind of human beings. But if you scratch the surface, as you mentioned, Nene, you see the darkest types of persons that you can encounter in life.
Yeah, I am thinking of a particular scene that made me think of that, which is the concert scene. So the thing is, Redmond, he joins the army for different, well, there's a duel that goes wrong. He gets robbed. He has to join the army to earn money. He deserts. He meets this woman, beautiful, and he marries. But she already has a son, and this son truly, truly, truly does not like Barry. He can actually read through him like a letter, like water. He sees through him immediately, and is the one character that truly speaks truth throughout. And I'm thinking of a concert scene where Lady Lyndon is giving a concert, and her eldest son, who's now about 18, and he really has shown how much he detests Barry Lyndon throughout, and he comes in, and this is a beautiful scene of a concert. She's playing the clavichord, and everybody's sitting, and with her wigs so powder, and everybody, you know, so beautiful, and there's actually an orchestra behind her, and everything is beautiful, and he comes in with his little brother, Lady Lyndon, and Barry Lyndon's young son, who's about 8, and they come in making noise, and you know, all hell breaks loose. Like literally, there's this like a fist fight, like a violent fist fight in this very, very stuffy, amazing wood paneled, clavichord clad room. And it's insane. I was laughing. I was losing my mind. I was like, this is insanity. And they just, it was so violent. It was like an explosion of violence. And you can see people, there's one aristocrat, a guy who is coming to help, and his lips, because the shoes are so shiny, and his lips on the floor, get into the fight. I mean, it's ridicule, right? It's insane. All these very well-dressed men with their satin things, just having this. And I was just, I thought that was genius. I thought that was a truly a genius mise-en-scene, like the tension that builds and builds and builds, and then it explodes in this. And for me, this is like the core. You know, yeah, there's multiple readings of the movie. Obviously, for me, this is the core reading for me, how fragile this whole parade, this whole system, like not just how they act, but the whole system of the aristocracy, how, you know, how fragile and how ridiculed and how inauthentic it is.
Yeah, Nene, and that the man slips on the floor was one of my highlights. And, you know, it might have happened. Yeah. You know, it was maybe not scripted, but they did it. And it's a small detail, but as you said, it's like not even your polished shoes or, you know, on this polished floor, everything is polished, but you still fall down and you beat everything that you can on this person. I love that detail. And they left it, obviously. So they wanted to say something with that man sleeping on the floor.
It actually, you know, enters very well in one of the main themes of Kubrick's filmography, which is the use of physical violence as a way or means of us pretend to be civilized. And you see this in The Clockwork Orange. You see this in Full Metal Jacket. You see it obviously in Dr. Strangelove. So, you know, it is definitely in 2001 when in that famous scene of the monkey throwing the bone through the air and turning into the space station, that violence, you know, we have used through our history as a way to see who we are, and it doesn't work, you know. It's just not.
I have something to add about this violence. One of the things I kept thinking is that the theme of the duels.
Exactly.
Obviously, duels were a thing in the 18th century. They were already illegal. They were illegal because, I'm not sure if they were illegal, but if you actually killed a man during a duel, you will be prosecuted and you will have to pay for that. So it was, it's such a strange thing because it was a system. It was an honor system. It was something that people did to settle accounts. Right? The movie starts with a duel. Barry's dad dies in a duel. He then, his whole journey, quote unquote, his whole adventure starts with a duel where he thinks he has killed the major. And throughout the movie, and then we have an extremely important sequence involving another duel between Barry and his son, this same son where they had this horrific fight in the concert. And these three scenes of the duels are, I think, extremely important to show how we even try to, you know, violence, we try exists, but we try to organize it. And they actually take the time to show the entire duels from beginning to end in each of the, well, the first one is just shot from a wide angle. Exactly. And it's just like a painting, but the other two are extremely detailed.
Yes.
You get the pistol. You get the pistol. I mean, every step. And it's just, you see the madness of how such a system could be created. And you think, how do we come up with this? Men.
And yet, you know what? And yet in the movie, in the duels and in the battle scenes, we never see blood. We never see blood. Because it's precisely that, because we try to sanitize it. We try to detach ourselves from that violence. It doesn't matter. It's not human because nobody bleeds. It's just a number. It's just something we do to achieve something. And it's just,
Exactly. And it's a metaphor for war, obviously. It's a metaphor for how war evolved throughout history to become even, you know, we see this extraordinary scene that Julio was describing before where the British army is advancing and they're just keeping this honorable, you know, system where they just keep walking with the bayonets because I guess their technique is to attack right when they're right in front of the other army. So I think he's also commenting on this, like Julio said, sanitize it from a distance, make it into this system. And in some way, this makes it a little bit more civilized. Yeah, we're killing each other, but you know, we're being honorable and honorable about it.
Yep.
Gabi, should we go to the next topic?
Well, you know, before we move on, I would like to maybe go back to some comments that Julio said at the very beginning of our discussion about the film being very masculine and in some ways also a little bit misogynistic, because it is full of testosterone throughout. What are your thoughts on this, and which elements made you confirm this view on the film? I don't know who wants to go first.
Well, you know, you can see it. To answer these questions, all you have to do is look at the female characters of the movie. They're quaint, restrained. They barely speak. Take for example, the mother of Redmond. She has, we learned that when she became a widow, she became completely, you know, devoted to her son. She never remarried. And she rarely speaks in the movie. She's always devoted to him, even till the end. That lady peasant that he encounters, and that she has a one-year-old, and she is this character of like a damsel in distress that needs this man to be her companion because she's alone and has a baby, you know. And here he comes, a knight in shining armor on a horse with a pristine, even though this man is coming from war, he's perfectly dressed in his uniform. And, you know, the woman asks him to stay with her and all these things. And even, you know, Lady Linden, you know, how she's pretty much used, and yes, she's in love. Yes, she's, you know, I mean, completely enamored by this man, but she's just another prop in this man's life. And the female characters, all they do is glance and bask at his glory. But do you remember any memorable lines from any other female characters? No. There aren't any, because this is a very male-centric, chauvinistic even film.
Totally. Very good. That's the right question. And, you know, curiously enough, Maddie Berenson, the actress who plays the role of Lady Linden, she has less than 100 lines in the entire film. She's one of the main characters. She has the fewest lines. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and she doesn't appear until halfway through the movie. And the first, and she's glancing at this man, beautifully, exquisitely lit by the candles. And that's it. She's just a prop. And it's sad. Yeah. It's sad. And I don't think you could easily say that this is a product of the times, but I think this is more of a commentary by Kubrick on, you know, how a male-dominated world sees women in general, and no matter the age, no matter the times, you know, there are men out there that still see women as props, and that has been a constant throughout history.
Yeah,
and it's something.
Yeah,
and it's something that, you know, in this movie, speaking specifically about this movie, is very evident in the fact that you don't remember any lines from the female characters at all. At all.
Yeah. Thank you for bringing this topic back, and thank Gabby, and thank you, Julio, for mentioning it. Definitely, you know, there's like there's like four female characters in the movie, and yeah, they are some of them are more props than others. Lady Linden is the most prop of all, in every sense, in that that Barry uses her to climb the aristocratic ladder. And you know what? I was very surprised. I don't know. I guess I was too in love with this movie that I didn't see this coming. When they meet at a salon playing cards, and like Julio was describing, it's this magnificently lit scene where they're sitting across the table, and you know, Barry is a handsome man, and that's why he's able to kind of conquer different like women as he goes through his adventures, and one of them is Lady Linden, and yeah, she's very statuesque, and you know, I was really surprised, and I'm not sure why. I really thought that he loved her, but it turns out he doesn't. I actually thought that he loved her, because in the very beginning of the movie, when he falls in love with his cousin, he's actually, I mean, you can read it as he's heartbroken, but it was more like a childish, like a temper tantrum.
Like a crush.
A crush. And also, because she doesn't pay any attention to him at the beginnings. But Lady Linden, she's not very practical at all. But she's, very. I didn't know that she had less than 100 lines, Gabby. All the attention is given to all the all the male characters throughout the movie.
And even the fact that her emotions, we learn that she's in love with Redmond because the narrators tell us so. Even her emotions have to be described by a man, and that for me, that's why it's so powerful, that final scene of hers when she's signing up the checks, the paperwork, and she hesitates to. She's like this. She has this blank stare, and papers are being passed on, and she's just signing them, and then she sees, we see the text that the 500 guineas. And you can feel the hesitation, but at the end, it's just another stroke of the pen. It's just, the lack of
depth. She's totally put it to the.
Yeah, but I'm going to say something interesting to me right now. The way everything, the way these female characters are portrayed in the movie, it kind of fits with this whole atmosphere of these being kind of like paintings, of being tableaus, tableau vivant, in a way. So people are just kind of posing in their roles, it's like Gabby and I are so quick to catch, misogyny in films. And it's like, obviously we this is one of the main topics that comes over and over in our discussions, because a lot of these movies are about, how difficult the lives of women were in different periods of history. I wasn't thinking of that in this movie, because everything, everybody, men and women seem to be playing a role in a painting or a tableau. But it's true. I was also thinking when I was watching the movie at the beginning, I said, okay, this is a very different movie from the ones that Gabby and I watch. Because Gabby and I have been talking a little bit more about genre in recent episodes, where we're trying to kind of figure out what is the purpose of period film, or what attracted us to period film. And we often say, well, finally, a genre that tells the intimate stories of women in general. This movie does not at all. This movie is not at all about the interior life of anybody.
No.
And least of all the women.
There is one key scene. It's also pretty much to the last third of the film. Barry Lyndon and Lady Lyndon have already had their baby, their son, Brian. And then we see, I think it's an iconic shot, then we see Lady Lyndon in a beautiful gown in the nursery room. On one side, she has her older son, Bullingdon, and on the other side, she has the crib with the baby, with Brady. And the narrator is saying, yeah, Barry Lyndon told his wife that now that she has a baby, she has to, she should dedicate herself now to being a mom and, taking care of the kids, because that should be her biggest joy. And he would take over the frivolities of life. And that shot for me was, it really left a big impression on me. We see a close up of her, and then the camera moves out and zooms out and gives the entire picture of her, in a very melancholy posture, sits in this armchair with her kids next, left and right, beautifully dressed, but kind of condemned to this room and to this role, put upon by her husband. It was not her decision.
No.
He said, now you're a mom and you have to dedicate it. And that shot for me was amazingly done. Also, maybe when we talk about it later, one of the many things that distinguish this film in the technical side. All these long shots with the zoom out, I think they were amazing. But anyhow, that scene for me was like the key moment of she has absolutely no priority in Barry Lyndon's life. And maybe to close the circle on that, Julio, I guess it's not a thing about the time. It's certainly a decision made by Kubrick to portray it like this. If we consider what he had done already with the entire queer-coded moments, mm-hmm. and this, I think it was his conscious decision to put this, to throw this in, to how to portray women.
Yeah. So we have talked at length about the movie, some of the things of the movie. There's so much to talk about. In fact, it could be a whole series of episodes about this movie. But we want to move on to our favorite segment of the episode, which is called the Wicks and Candles Quiz, which will give us the opportunity to talk about other aspects that we haven't touched on yet. So, the quiz consists of four questions, and each of us are going to answer. So we start with, of course, our special guest, Julio. We start with our first question. What is your sweaty wig? One thing you didn't like about the movie?
The way it treated women. The female characters. That's what I didn't like about the movie.
Yeah. Yeah, I have a question for you. Do you think this is... Okay, how do I phrase this? Because is this a function of how Kubrick, the director, and the screenwriter, and the filmmakers portray the characters? Or are you thinking the way the characters themselves treated the characters? Or do you think the film is commenting on this? I want to know what
I think. Kubrick is commenting on this, indeed. I think it's a deliberate way to portray the mischaracterization and the detachment that the males of the time treated women and saw them as, you know, mere props and just pawns in their own personal games. Yes, they are to be respected and to be cherished and to be, you know, nurtured, but they're only seeing nothing more as mothers or ways to bring fortune to their own families by way of marriage. So, you know, I think it's a commentary on the times, indeed, but it's also a commentary on the overall way that some type of men treat women. Because even if you look at the times, you know, by that time that the movie takes place, in the period the movie takes place, you know, it's after Shakespeare. It's after, you know, it's Jane Austen is almost there, you know. I mean, there are characterizations of women as, you know, already on that period as creatures of wit and you know, as and almost equal to men, you know. But that is not the case in this universe in where Barry Lyndon inhabits, that Barry Lyndon inhabits. And yeah, it's certainly a commentary on overall how certain type of men treat women.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you.
It is a very sweaty
week. What about you, Gabby? Do you want to comment? Do you want to comment on this, or you want to tell us your own sweaty week?
Well, I do have a sweaty week, but I would like to comment shortly. I agree with you that this is a deliberate decision of the director to comment on this aspect on society. So yeah, I agree with that. It's just it's just something that keeps repeating throughout, and maybe the thing that makes it in this film a little bit fresh is that they left it really much very true to the time situation. For the life of women was horrible in that time, and they didn't make it look any nicer or any prettier, or they didn't romanticize anything. They said, okay, women were treated like props, and this is what we're showing you. So I think it was kind of, in that sense, kind of accurate to the tone of society in those days. My sweaty week is something very, very simple, because it was very difficult for me to pick anything that I didn't like about the film, because I found the film incredible, all in all. So I was really giving it a hard thought. And I came up with the hairdo of Barry Lyndon in the first segment of the film. It was like a fluffy 70s hairdo that did not do Ryan O'Neill as an actor any favor. That is my sweaty week. It might sound banal, it might sound very superficial to mention his hair, but as I said, it was very difficult for me to pick something that I didn't like, because visually this film is a feast for the eye. Technically, it is incredible if we think this is from 1975. This is nearly 50 years old, this film. What they did back then, and so on. So all the things that I saw were positive. So I really had to dig in deep to find a sweaty wig, and I picked Barry Lyndon's hair. Thank you. Lenny, how about your sweaty wig? One thing you didn't like about the film.
Thank you for both of your sweaty wigs. My sweaty wig is extremely, extremely superficial, given how, you know, important this movie is, given its legacy, given its themes. And it has to do with a pair of pants. At the very beginning of the movie, when Barry Lyndon is called a boy multiple times, he's wearing this khaki, this kind of light brown pair of pants. In fact, this is the same pair of pants, trousers, that he actually goes on his adventure. This is the pair of pants that he embarks on his adventure. And this pair of pants is so ill-fitting. After that, all the costumes are pretty good.
I think that was the purpose of it. And you noticed it. Is to reinforce the fact that this is a boy, this is a child. He cannot fit properly in a man's pants because he's a boy.
There you go. My goodness. Okay, so let me rephrase this. So Stanley Kubrick is such a genius that the one sweaty wig, because I had to dig very deep to find even a sweaty hair in this entire movie. There was not one sweaty hair, but I had to dig very deep. But even what I thought was a sweaty wig was, in fact,
something genius.
Something genius, as Julio has just pointed out. Unbelievable. Okay. Well, yeah. Anyway, but yeah, so there you have it. Okay. So let's move on to the second question of the quiz. My God, this is going to be hard. Julio. What is your shining candle? One thing you loved about Barry Lyndon?
Ryan O'Neill's performance.
Okay.
I don't know. I mean, I think he's I don't know if Kubrick chose him because he's a very wooden actor. But, you know, you can he embodies to me. This performance embodies to me a self-absorbed, detached person in an incredible way. Like, I mean, there's no life in his eyes. He's just there and functioning almost by instinct, doing what he's supposed to do because he has to. and almost mechanical, almost feral to a point. And I don't know if this is, he's, I don't know if he was this type of actor or what, but his performance was, I mean, to convey this vast emptiness inside is not easy.
Great. Oof. Yeah, very good. Oof. I'm pretty sure.
All the technical, this is a technical marvel, exquisitely shot. The costumes, that is, but you need to embody you need somebody to embody the fakeness of it all. And he nailed it.
Yeah. I kept thinking, you know, when I was watching the movie and I was thinking, okay, is this because this is based on this type of novel, the picaresque novel? And I'm not too familiar, but a little bit familiar, but I kept thinking, my goodness, Barry is somebody, or Redman, and later Barry, is somebody to whom things happen to. Things happen to him. Things keep happening to him. He's a blank slate for things to happen. And yeah, he makes a couple of decisions here and there, but things keep happening, and he has to make just a small correction in his choice, in his just a small course correction. How do you say, to portray this vast emptiness? he did amazing. But you know what? It's weird because I still, it's like he's very memorable. He's kind of unforgettable in a way.
Yeah, well, good looks will take you very far. And he's been an iconic actor from the 70s. And yeah. And he made this movie, for crying out loud. He's one of the few.
I know.
But yeah.
All right. Okay, perfect. Thank you for that shining candle. What about you, Gabby? What is your shining candle? One thing you loved.
My shining candle. I think we have spoken about this before. Technically and visually, this film is a true masterpiece. So here with this question, I actually had to struggle to pick only one thing that I really liked, because I could have picked 1,000. So I'm going to go for one scene. My shining candle is the scene of Barry and Lady Lyndon, where they meet the first time for real. They are playing cards in the salon, and at some point Lady Lyndon gets up because she needs some fresh air, and she goes out to the balcony, and she's standing there for some time, and then Barry comes out and joins her. And this is the first time that they kiss in the film. And this was, for me, it is a very, very stiff, choreographed kiss. But for me, I will remember this as one of the best kissing scenes in period films ever, because the entire atmosphere was so sublime, and how delicate the movements were. For me, it was just exquisite. Also, maybe the contrast of the dark background and their bright attires, because they're both wearing bright colors, and how the wind just softly moved the feathers on her hat. For me, it was just impeccable. For me, it is one of the best kiss scenes that I've seen. That's my shining candle.
Wow, Gabby, thank you for that shining candle. You have effectively stolen my favorite scene of the movie.
Thank you. How about you, Nene? What's your shining candle?
Well, that was going to be the moonlight.
Okay.
That was going to be my shining candle, because I had a out-of-body experience the ones that I remember forever. Like, I will forever remember the first time I saw that scene. Mm-hmm. I will never forget the first time I saw that image. Mm-hmm. Like, it's before and after.
Yeah, but it's okay. So it's a valid shining candle, even though we have a very similar one.
What can I say? It's exquisite. It's beautiful. All right, I think we need to move on. Okay, everybody's nodding. Let's go to our third question: stolen costume or prop. So, Julio, what piece of clothing or prop would you like to keep from the movie?
Good question. I don't know. I'm not sure if anything would fit me, actually. If anything would actually fit me. But I don't know. Maybe the boots. I like the fact that because the burglar says to Redmond that he's going to let him keep the boots so he can keep on walking. So those must be some really interesting boots. So I would like to keep those boots too.
That is an amazing stolen costume or prop. Yeah, because he doesn't have those boots, he's doomed.
Exactly.
He's done.
Yeah, so it's a very important. And we don't even notice them until they're mm-hmm. mentioned by the burglar. And so, yeah, those are the... That would be a good thing to have. It's a good... They certainly took him far, so...
Exactly. All the way to you know, English aristocracy. Mm-hmm. Boom. Mm. Okay, what about you, Gabby? What stalling costume?
Okay, I have an anecdote about my prop. I picked a prop that when I saw it, I said, this is going to be my prop. I'm going to take with me. But during the course of the film, something happened that made this prop really creepy. So I had to change prop very fast. So originally I had picked the little coach that they use for Brian's 8th birthday. They are celebrating the 8th birthday of their kid, Brian. And one of the things that they had prepared for his birthday was that he was driving a little carriage that was pulled by two sheep, and they're all dancing around him, and it's decorated with feathers, and it's so cheerful and cute and small and whimsical. It was beautiful. Only that this kid dies during the film, and they use the same freaking carriage to carry the the coughing of the child. So,
no,
I am not taking that carriage.
No,
because it was too creepy. It was too tough. So anyhow, I changed that because, as I said, it was absolutely scary.
No, not appropriate.
Not appropriate. So I'm going to go for something very simple. Some of the women in some scenes had little sun umbrellas made of fabric to cover the sun. And I love those. I have a weakness for those umbrellas. And here they were also used very beautifully. So I'm going to take one of Lady Lyndon's umbrellas, white umbrellas.
Wow.
I think I've taken another one from another film, but as I said, I have a...
I'm collecting. You have a whole collection of umbrellas.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's a very good stolen costume or prop, and not taking a stolen costume or prop. I completely understand. No. Okay, for me, to be honest with you, I actually couldn't choose anything. I was just so mesmerized by art in capital letters throughout. I'm going to take something symbolic from this movie, because this movie is known by the lighting, by the cinematography. So I'm going to take a candlestick, one of the hundreds of candlesticks that they use in this movie to light up this magnificent piece of art.
Perfect.
And you know what? I don't think I ever taking a candlestick. I'm taking a few wicks. So I need a proper.
Nene, and this is very appropriate, very good one. And maybe some piece of trivia that we didn't mention before. Julio, you said that the candlelit scenes were really filmed only using the candlelight. They didn't use any electrical light to shoot those scenes. And additional to doing that, which was already challenging enough for them with the technology of the time, they had customized candles. So the candles, Stanley Kubrick had candles specially made for them with three, how do you call them? Three threads, not only one, but three.
Oh, wicks.
How do you call it?
The wick.
The wick.
Yeah, three wicks. Yeah.
3 weeks. W-I-C-K. So all the candles had three to create more light. To create more light, they made 3 wicks per candle, which is why they would burn faster. And this is why we see them always being very short, because they would burn very fast. But they were customized candles for this one.
Wow. And you know what? I was watching another featurette about, you know, about the movie, and they said that for those scenes in indoors with the candles, you know, you will see maybe a candlestick with 5 candles, and they say you think that the scene is being illuminated or lighted by just that, but actually we have a whole other set of candlesticks around to create more light, but no electrical light. They have more candlesticks, and they say they had so many of them that it was kind of like a nightmare for how do you call that? Continuity in editing. Yeah, because the candles would burn, and then you have to reshot the scene, and then it's like, oops, how do you edit if the candle is looking higher or lower? Ooh. And yeah, so it was a kind of like a nightmare for in terms of that, you know, continuity. But also, they had so many candles in some scenes that, you know, it was absorbing oxygen. So every time they say cut, they had to open to blow out the candles and people and open the windows and you know, because they had smoke. I mean, this whole thing about lighting the scenes with only candles created a whole set of elements that they had to deal with as well, that they could not foresee, right? It's like like smoke. There was so much more smoke, and in the costumes or in the walls, and because they didn't film in sets, this movie was shot on location. So these were actual castles, actual reading rooms, actual rooms in big states. They had to be so careful. Imagine you have all those works of art, all those curtains, all those rocks, and you have hundreds of candles.
Very good prop, Nene. I agree.
Well, all right. Okay, so let's go to the last question of the quiz. Again, we're going to ask our guest, Julio. If given the chance, would you time travel to the period? Yes, no, and why?
No, I'm good. Yeah, I'm good.
That was a clear answer.
Yeah, I know. It's okay. I'm good here now. I would perhaps, if I were to travel, would be to enjoy the nature and the weather and the pristine conditions of the time. But socially, I think that there's work that needed to be done, still is today. So, yeah, I'm good here.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Julio. What about you, Gabby?
Nene,
would you time travel to this period?
I am torn. But I'm actually tending to say no. I wouldn't like to go to this time. Maybe also because of everything that was going on in that spot of the earth where the film is taking place. There was a lot going on. The stiffness of society, how it is portrayed in the film, would I don't know, would also turn me off a little bit. I don't know. I tend to say no. I wouldn't time travel this time to the 18th century. Yeah, the entire makeup, and you know, it looked like sweaty.
Plus, nothing would fit me.
Well,
but Julio, there's Taylor. There's, come on,
it's a fantasy, so maybe you would get a customized.
No, and there's Taylor. Yes. Everything was customized.
True, true. That's
was,
true.
You didn't go to a shop to get
that's
stuff.
True. It was that's very much for true. You. That's very much true.
So that wouldn't be, a problem. That would not be a problem. So, Gabby, you wouldn't go. No, Julio wouldn't go.
Would you
okay,
go?
How about,
so who is going to
who's going to come with you?
Who's going to come with me? But people who have been listening to this podcast know, for some reasons, a part of my soul is in the 18th century. I don't know why. I guess I've seen too many paintings. I guess I've seen too many sheep pulling carriages. I don't know. I don't know what it is. But you know what? You know what? Even the ugliness of the aristocracy, right? Because this movie shows us the ugliness, the ridiculousness of this whole fashion, which is just happening 30 years before the French Revolution, right? When everything comes crashing down, and including the wigs, literally, right? Essentially, right after the revolution, there were no more wigs. It's finished, right? God, I just, I'm so curious to see this fashion in person. I'm so curious to see this powder white in the people's faces. I don't know why. But, and again, the conditions are that you can come back.
Yeah, you can come. It's a return ticket. Yes, of course.
Of course, there's always some risk that something malfunctions and you're stuck. And you're stuck there.
I'm totally good. Power to you, Ali. Enjoy.
Enjoy.
Listen.
Enjoy the powder.
You the shoes. Do you. The shoes, the powder, the you, wigs, you. The candles. I'll be watching you from here. I'm rooting for you.
Oh, I don't know. I want like a little book. And again, this is always turns out to be some fantasy. I want like a tiny little book that I can put inside my corset right in front, like I hide, like a forbidden book, like a forbidden book, like it's like a picaresque book.
That you can read under the
like
tree.
A book, like a book that ladies are not supposed to read, but I hide it in my corset in the front, and I have this corner window that I find, and I take the little book and I read it, and you know, maybe that. But no, seriously, this was not a good time. Especially there was a war. It's being serious. There was a horrific war happening in Europe at the time. And obviously, we have talked about this many times. You know, peasants were suffering. Women were treated like property. Men were also suffering. Men were also victims of this society. So obviously, not a good time. But you know. If I could read a little picaresque book under a tree.
You can do that now.
Oh, that's okay.
You can certainly do that now. And there are big maples in Canada. So go for it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's true. You know, this reminds me, I once declared publicly on social media that I wanted to die. And when I die, I wanted to come back as a bass player. And I wanted to come back, not any bass player. I wanted to come back as Lizzo's bass player.
Okay.
Right? And then I was telling this story to a bass player. And he said, you could just play the bass. You got a point.
Very good, Nene.
Listen, that is my world of fantasy, and that's why we have this podcast.
I love it. Okay.
Anyway, to wrap it up, is late here, and our guest has given us his time after a long day of work. How many weeks can... Oh, thank you so much. We're going to do our rating. How many wicks and candles do you give Barry Lyndon? And the rating is from 1 to 10, where 1 is a very sweaty wick, and 10 is all the wicks and candles.
I would give it a 10. Absolutely. Absolutely. It's a masterpiece. Terrific thing. A layered examination of the human soul, and which is everything that is art is supposed to be. So it's, I mean, beyond the technical aspects of it, which are exquisite and yet unparalleled, the message of the movie is that, you know, still resonates today, that not all travelers, I mean, are looking for answers. Not all travelers are looking for fulfillment. Not all travelers believe the road is the answer. And sometimes that is not okay.
Okay. That's amazing. Thank you so much, Julio. What about you, Gabby? What's your rating?
I'm going to give it a 10. There is really very little that turns me off from this film. It's I would have to highlight all the technical and visual aspects, because it was, for me, it was breathtaking. For me, it was a completely new, even though the film is old, a completely new cinematographic experience. And maybe also as a film lover and as a movie lover, as a kind of refreshing, we are now so spoiled with high tech and special effects and polished filmmaking, and to see the creativity, the innovation, the avant-garde elements throughout the entire production was for me like back to the roots. It was like, I didn't know it, but I figured my film lover soul was longing for something like this. So, and appreciates such works. So I'm going to give it a 10. It is, for me, remarkable. Certainly one of the best films I've seen ever. Maybe also Kubrick's style. I have to admit that I don't know many of his films. So for me, before I start adding nothing else, I'm just going to stick to my 10. Thank you. Okay. How about you, Nene?
Okay, thank you very much. Oh, unquestionable. Unquestionably a 10. There's nowhere to go. And what you said, Gabby, is amazing. It's like we didn't realize how much we needed this movie. And I felt the same way. I felt the same way, because we have seen so many, and I'm going to stick to period film here. We've seen over 25 movies for this podcast now. And, you know, we have seen some remarkable stories and technical achievements as well. But the depth of storytelling, the depth of examination of the human soul, like Julio said, the depth of exploring art to its fullest, in this case, film, is unparalleled, like truly. And I was thirsty for it too. And it kind of spoils a lot of movies for me. And it's like, wow, this was the template. And it actually is going to make me think a lot about all the films that come after. And why, it's probably, the answer is probably practical. Like, why none took this mantle? they took it, but not fully. And it's probably because it's impossible. Nobody could do what Kubrick did. The strength, you know, the, you know, this movie took 300 days to shoot. Like his pre-production was like one whole year or more, like a year and a half. It was, so not every movie has that luxury. Not every director has that luxury. And that's probably why it hasn't been matched. It's a masterpiece at every level. Yeah. It's, for me, it will even inform what comes after. Like it will even inform the movies I've seen and that we have talked about and everything that we'll see from now on.
Totally. And you know, maybe one more thing about that. As I said, I'm not very familiar with Kubrick's work, but I admire how he built up the tension in like nearly every scene. He built up the tension so well. And then you're really like expecting something to explode, you know, like with a very 2024 kind of trained brain, you're really expecting the next bang. But then it's just like, one sentence, one move of the hand, something very subdued. And that is art. That is, for me, they didn't need to make anybody bleed or, I don't know, anything explicit. And you got the message perfectly because this tension building is just, this is, you have to master that skill as a filmmaker. So, yeah, for me, it's a very high bar.
I agree. Very high bar. I mean, it's just editing. Editing is sublime. How do you build the rhythm of these scenes? The rhythm of the dual scenes. It's just at every level. It's just above and beyond anything we've seen so far in this podcast. And this is not to take away any of the brilliant movies that we have seen. We have seen some amazing films and stories, but this is on another level. And I think I said it at the beginning, this goes beyond period film. This is just and, you know, people might think that is hyperbole. I am very sure of my rating. Like, I don't have to revisit this at all.
Okay.
Anyway.
Very good.
We could talk a lot more, but we're gonna cut it here. Thank you so much, Julio, for talk to us about this
movie. Thank you guys for inviting me. It's a great honor to again come back home to you guys after all these years. And thank you for this podcast. It's beautiful. Thank you for sharing your beautiful insights with the world through this medium. And I am honored and I am your super fan. Thank you.
Thank you, Julio. Thank you for joining
thank
us.
Thank you.
For your support.
That's you. Amazing. And we can do it again.
Oh, so. I'll be waiting for the call.
All right.
Very good.
It's going to come. Right. Don't worry. Gabby, as always, thank you so much for all the work you do. Thank you for your insights, for this conversation. I love it so much. Thank you.
Thank you, Nene. Thank you as well. And yes, we hope that you enjoy the discussion and the conversation and that you stay tuned.
Exactly. Everybody listening, thank you so much. And this is the end of the season. See you in season 5. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Wicks and Candles is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher.
So go ahead and subscribe. And follow us on Instagram @WicksandCandles. Thanks for listening and see you next time.